You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm joined once again by Lionel Burney.
Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, Lionel. And Ian Boswell.
Good afternoon, Richard.
Well, it's afternoon with you, of course. Yeah, the time difference. Unfortunately, Daniel is serving a one podcast suspension for upsetting our American audience. I think probably on more than one occasion. So a yellow card is a, you know, sort of sin bin for Daniel. He will rejoin you tomorrow night, I think, Lionel.
He will, yes. We'll be recapping tomorrow's Giro stage because you're off to the Tour of Flanders. I didn't want to get into this yesterday, Daniel offending Americans, but also a bold move that when you consider there are 17 million Italian-Americans.
Well, someone's been doing their research today, haven't they?
Well, I wanted to catch Daniel out with some facts. this sort of thing about cuisine, it bugs me. It gets under my skin. You know, when the Italians took their cuisine to America and the Americans, Italians have put their spin on it, does that mean that Italian-American cuisine is somehow inauthentic, or is it just a different kind of authentic? My view is it's the latter. I mean, I remember having a really nice meal in an Italian restaurant in New York, and I ordered the meatball marinara, which I can already, you know, Daniel would be wincing at the very idea of it. And it was pasta with one giant meatball on the top. And they were really proud of this dish, and it was excellent. But, I mean, you wouldn't get that in a little, a little restaurant tucked away in one of his hilltop hideaways, I guess.
But I like Chicago pizzas as well. well, I mean,
why not?
Why not?
Well, it wasn't until early in this Giro when you were down south and you had some arancini or arancino, however you say it. But I was in Boston a couple years ago and my wife's mother wanted to go get arancini. And I thought this must not be an Italian dish. This has to be an American creation to deep fry rice and cheese. But turns out, lo and behold, it is an Italian dish.
Could be Scottish. So. It could be Scottish.
If you wrapped it in meat, it would be Scottish.
this sounds like Daniel's anyway. Really is suspended. He isn't. He isn't. It's his last night at home before he heads off for yet another Grand Tour. He's going to the Vuelta tomorrow. So rightly, he's enjoying an evening with his girlfriend rather than talking about a time trial with us. I mean, that's probably got something to do with it as well.
Well, fair play.
I mean,
Daniel's the Marino Lajarreta or the Adam Hansen of the podcast, isn't he? Doing all three Grand Tours this year.
He is. I was going to say time trial is not really his thing, but with his new sort of tech interest, maybe it would be. Noticed Fabian Cancellara talking about Filippo Ganna today, saying that he's far better than he ever was. And it was another Ganna day, top Ganna. Another great day for Ineos Grenadiers, who cemented consolidated their place at the top of the team's classification. They are the new Movistar, clearly. But have you got a tale of the Tapa for us, please, Lionel?
I'm not sure Movistar won four stages in many of those races when they were targeting the team's classification. I'm sure they have won multiple stages. But no, it's turning into a pretty good Giro for Ineos Grenadiers, considering they came in with overall hopes with Geraint Thomas, which obviously bit the dust way back in Sicily. But as you say, Rich, yeah, Filippo Ganna and Rowan Dennis doing an Ineos Grenadiers 1-2 in the time trial. It was a lumpy old course, 34 kilometres to Val d'Orbiadene. I probably mangled the pronunciation of that, but you know, Daniel's not here.
Doesn't matter.
Correct.
Doesn't matter.
So it literally doesn't matter. And it really split into two halves, didn't it? In the first couple of hours, the race for the stage was what sustained our interest. Then there was a bit of a lull, and then the GC riders tackled the course towards the end of the afternoon. The stage really, well, once Dennis and Ganna were on the road, it was fairly obvious early on that they were going to blow away the times of Mateusz Brandley, Kamil Gradek, the Polish champion, who was a leader briefly before Viktor Kampenerz became the first to go under 45 minutes. And then Josef Czerny went under 44 minutes, but then Rowan Dennis, 43 minutes and 6 seconds, was 50 seconds faster. And then Filippo Ganna, who really scorched round the course in his rainbow jersey, 42 minutes and 40 seconds. Very, very impressive by Ganna. And third place went to Brandon McNulty of UAE Team Emirates, who Ian Boswell was tipping in last night's podcast as someone who would do a good ride. And it really was an excellent ride. Best of the GC riders. Fourth was Thomas de Gendt. Fifth was Czerny, as I mentioned. And sixth was the Maglia Rosa, João Almeida. And Almeida is now 56 seconds clear of Wilco Kelderman. And those two have put a bit of daylight between themselves and the rest. Pao Bilbao stays third, but he's now 2:11 behind. McNulty, the big mover today, up to fourth place. 7 places he's risen in the GC from 11th. Nibali stays fifth, but now he's 2 minutes 30 behind. Mike has moved up a couple of places. Pozzovivo slipped down 3. Really is a game of snakes and ladders in the top 10 of the GC, because Masnada's up to 8th. Conrad and Hindley both fell 3 places. They're 9th and 10th. And then Theo Gegenhardt is up 1 to 11th. He's 3 minutes 44 down. And I guess Fuglsang, who had probably the worst ride of the GC riders, he's now 12th at 4 minutes and 8, and really kind of on the fringes of the GC, especially with an uphill finish tomorrow to Piancavallo, where Pantani won in 1998, and in 2017 it's where Nairo Quintana took the pink jersey from Tom Dumoulin towards the end of that Giro. Of course, Dumoulin got it back in the time trial on the last day and won that Giro. But the question is, with Almeida now 56 seconds ahead of Kelderman, and the weather and whatever the final week may bring, the youngster, the Portuguese youngster, is looking very, very good in this Giro.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWaka. If you run a business, find out more at iwoca.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, thank you very much to iWaka, who have been sponsoring us since the spring. And, well, if you don't know about iWaka, well, we mention them in every podcast. They're a company which supports small businesses by lending money. And one of the things that they've innovated this year was the iWaka Pay. Well, it's an app, but it's a system which enables small and medium-sized businesses to bridge the gap in their finances. So one of the biggest challenges for small businesses is that they often have to pay out invoices, you know, on say 30 days, but maybe we'll be collecting money in that they're owed over a longer period of time. And that gap for small and medium businesses can be really tricky. And so the iWaka Pay app effectively bridges that gap. And if you want to find out more about it, go to iwoca.co.uk and check out the website. Lots of information on there if you run a small business.
Well, apparently, Lionel, I said in episode 1 of our Giro d'Italia coverage back in Palermo that nobody saw João Almeida, or it might have been when he took the pink jersey, I'm not sure. I'm no desire to go back and check what I said. But apparently I said nobody saw him or nobody considered him as an overall contender. That was accurate. Nobody did consider him as an overall contender. But they're maybe starting to now. It feels still a bit premature. These are big time gaps we're looking at now. But it is the Giro, isn't it? And, you know, you only have to go back to 2016 and the last Giro that Vincenzo Nibali won. He overturned a 4 minute, 4.45 gap, I think it was, on Stephen Kruijswijk. Albeit Kruijswijk had a crash, but you know, things can change, and especially in this race, as we've said repeatedly, no dominant team, no team that looks like able to control it, although Deceuninck Quick-Step are doing a fabulous job and had another great day today, not just with Almeida, but with their other riders too. Almeida's starting to look like a credible challenger. I would perhaps not put it any more strongly than that.
I'm not sure. I mean, this is the drum I keep beating, but we just don't know what the weather is going to do to the final week. The big climbs could be avoided, altered. Stages may well, be beyond recognition compared to what's in the roadbook. And these gaps, as you say, Rich, they've opened up. And if I was one of those riders in the sort of the everyone really up to Fuglsang, who I guess is the last of the contenders at the moment, starting to worry a little bit about Almeida. Tomorrow is a big test, isn't it? Piancavallo is a decent climb. There's a lot of climbing on the way to it, and it's an opportunity to put Almeida and his team under some pressure. But at what point is somebody going to make a move and try to crack him? It is getting to that point where they will have to try to crack him, because if they just all ride around with him in their slipstream, Almeida's going to get within striking distance of winning the Giro, and then the weather could intervene. And then, as we've seen, I know the final time trial is a much flatter one, but you would think he wouldn't be in danger of losing too much time to the people that are stacked up behind him. So it's really fascinating. And the one thing that really struck me today was, Almeida was going to come into this Giro as support for Remco Evenepoel, of course. And, I was dubious about whether Evenepoel would be able to mount a challenge over 3 weeks in a race as tough as the Giro. And yet here we are with someone who was intending to come in as support for Evenepoel doing exactly that. It really is quite some performance. And like I say, particularly, Nibali with 2 minutes 30 to make up, I think time is running out. And what I'm hoping is that means that tomorrow's stage, we see a little bit of panic amongst those riders who know that they've got to start recovering some of the time that they lost today.
Just on Deceuninck Quick-Step, they've got four riders in the top 24 on GC, which is impressive. And Mikel Honoré, who's 24th, proposed to his girlfriend today before the start of the time trial. So there we go, his Italian girlfriend. Sorry, Ian.
What did she say? Sorry, Ian. What was the answer?
I don't know.
Well, I was going to kind of just follow up on where Almeida is. I mean, it reminds me a lot of the 2019 tour with Alaphilippe. I mean, he almost, in a way, for me, kind of feels like a placeholder at the top of the leaderboard. And there's been a lot made about there not really being a dominant team here. But if you saw, the stage yesterday, mentioning there are four Quick-Step riders in the top 24. I mean, that's a pretty, if you look across the results, they appear to be the strongest team. And, having Masnada and James Knox both up there to be climbing support, Almeida is going to get a lot more support in the mountains than Alaphilippe did in 2019 at the Tour. But like you said, it really is going to depend on kind of how the last week shapes up and what stages we actually see go ahead. Because if we don't hit the super high mountains, then I could see him, potentially hanging on. But I still feel like he's just such an unknown name for so many fans that I feel like, we're so accustomed to seeing these same Grand Tour riders rise to the top. And as you said, in 2016, Nibali overturned a 4.5 minute deficit. And I would not count Nibali out if the race goes ahead to come up and bite the pink.
That's a good point, Ian, because, from our perspective as, we're observers, or Richard and I are observers. I mean, we're kind of going off previous performances and trying to, glean any clues from his stage racing earlier in the season. Oh, he was ninth in Algarve and third in Burgos and seventh in the Tour de l'Ain and so on. Looking for clues, there's nothing really comparable to even the first 2 weeks of the Giro d'Italia, let alone the third week. But will the riders, will they be aware? Because just from watching, I haven't seen any obvious cracks in Almeida. He doesn't look to have any obvious weaknesses or flaws. He's obviously good at climbing. He's a decent, very decent time trialist. And, we saw just yesterday, getting over the climbs and then trying to win a sprint finish against, you know, some pretty handy finishes. There doesn't look to be an awful lot to go at the moment. And that's why I'm wondering whether people will start to think tomorrow they have to really put him under a bit of pressure. We could see some very aggressive racing from the more experienced and hardier Grand Tour riders.
Well, we haven't seen a whole lot of uphill finishes just yet. And that's why I kind of draw the comparison to Alaphilippe in 2019 when, you know, he hit the time trial late in the race and everyone thought he was going to lose the yellow jersey, and he won the time trial and no one really had expected that. And I wonder if Almeida's kind of riding a similar wave of, you know, youthful excitement, and you see him, you know, sprinting for stage wins, and he's racing much differently than maybe you would see someone at Ineos Grenadiers ride had they been in, you know, a leadership position at this race. So, I mean, it really, you know, he's clearly on some incredible form, but, you know, this final week of the Giro is pretty stacked with some tough stages. And that's when, you know, just looking through the results of these names, you know, that are just kind of, you know, riders that are always up there, you know, even someone like Rafał Majka is still, he's still, you know, within reaching distance, and, you know, Nibali is never one to be counted out. But that said, you know, Wilco Kelderman is the closest up there, and he's, you know, so far had a clean run at this Grand Tour, which is something that he hasn't really had, you know, too many clean runs at a complete Grand Tour before.
The thing about these races, whether it's Simon Yates in 2018 at the Giro, or, you know, Julian Alaphilippe last year, you can only go on what you've seen up to that point. And, you know, when you look back on the race after the fact, you can always sort of look at Simon Yates and go, well, he clearly used too many bullets at this point and that point and that point. And you know, we're all wise after the fact. Alaphilippe, even you know, it was very popular to say after the tour that he was never going to win it. Clearly, he was always going to crack at some point. But you know, it didn't look like that deep into the race. And it could be the same with Almeida, that so far not a sign of weakness, as you say, Lionel. But you know, he's never ridden 3 weeks before, so he doesn't know how he's going to do in this third week. None of us do, and I don't think his team do. I remember speaking to Jeroen Swart at the Vuelta last year, and Tadej Pogacar was a similar sort of revelation. I mean, it was his first Grand Tour. He was only 21 at the time, I guess, or 2021. And, you know, they didn't know how he was going to get on in the third week. And I remember meeting him on the penultimate morning and asking how he was. And he said, he's, you know, his recovery every day is fantastic, you know. And that's what they'll be looking at within De Koenig Quickstep as well. How's he recovering? How's his body? And we're not really privy to that. But he might have a horrific day. He might crack on one of these climbs, or he might just lose enough to lose the position that he's in. We don't know. He doesn't know. But you do tend to look at the guys with the miles on the clock, you know, the Nibali, Majka as well. Majka's pretty well positioned. I mean, he had a pretty good day today. But Wilco man is really, he's got pedigree, and he's going really well. I think today confirmed that. He is in a really strong position. But the other guys, again, a new guy, Brandon McNulty, I mean, moved up 7 places on GC today to 4th, also 22. American rider. What do you know about him, Ian? Do you know him well?
I've spoken to him a few times when he was at Team Rally, and he had some really strong performances, must have been 2 years ago. But I don't know a ton about him. I've exchanged a few messages. He was looking at moving to Nice, but yeah, he's an incredibly hard worker. You know, he spent more time kind of racing domestically here in the US with Rally before moving up. And I think he's been pretty, you know, he's been steadily improving every year, and he's been very cautious about his, you know, development and his curve. You know, he had the opportunity to go to the World Tour younger than, you know, he did, but he decided to wait and join UAE once, you know, he felt like he was ready. And I think he's, you know, clearly come out of, you know, lockdown showing some great form, and his time trial today was phenomenal. I think, you know, you mentioned Richard last night, Michael Berg, about, you know, a potential stage winner. And I think that Berg, they had raced together a couple times as U23, and I think Berg won Time Trial Worlds both times. I think McNulty was either second or third. So, you know, he's had some good showings in time trials over the course of his career, and he can clearly climb as well. But like Almeida, this is his first go at a Grand Tour.
And this, you know, this a time trial, we said it in Palermo, but even more so now, you know, 2 weeks into the race, a time trial is such a test of form and recovery and so on. And everybody's talking about Almeida, but McNulty took more than 20 seconds out of him today. And McNulty is a guy who can climb as well. You know, he could if he's getting better or tiring less quickly, then he could emerge as the challenger as well.
He very well could. I do remember a few years back at the Tour de l'Avenir, I think he was riding pretty high overall, and he did have a bad day there and lost a fair chunk of time. And I think there's been a few other races, even this season, where he's been riding really well and then randomly he'll have a bad day and lose a big chunk of time. But he tends to come back, you know, pretty strongly. But he does, you know, he hasn't really shown the consistency of some of the other Grand Tour contenders who we see up in the top 10.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Harry's Razors. Richard, you're a long-time smooth customer, smooth operator, a long-time customer of Harry's Razors, aren't you?
Well, don't know what you're getting at there. I do use Harry's Razors. I've been using them since they began advertising the podcast. Few facts and figures on Harry's. They bought a factory in Germany that's been making blades for over 100 years. The factory team has more than 600 engineers, designers, craftsmen, and chemists who make Harry's products from the finest materials and ingredients. Ian, you let slip that you actually became a Harry's customer as well when you heard an advert on the podcast.
I did, yeah. As a cyclist, went through quite a few razors, both shaving mainly my legs and eventually my face when I started growing facial hair. And being on the road, traveling so much, that's the one thing that I seem to always forget was packing enough razors. So I did sign up for Harry's, thanks to you guys. And now it's one thing I never have to think about. To be fair, I went for the lowest plan. I don't go through all that many razors, but yeah, they're always stocked in my cupboard when I'm in need of a clean shave, which I'm in need of a clean shave this weekend.
Well, we're not making this up, folks. This is fantastic stuff from our guest presenter, Ian, putting in a really strong claim to become a permanent presenter. Get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support the cycling podcast and get your trial set delivered to your door. That includes the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel, and the travel blade cover. Go to harrys.com/cycling. That's harrys.com/cycling.
Forget all the years of experience racing in the World Tour that you bring to the podcast, all the anecdotes, all of that first-hand knowledge. You can just remember a discount code or, be on message. I mean,
if you've used some of the products we're advertising, managers. That's fantastic.
Well, it was actually such a good deal. I actually ordered, they have a female range of razors, and I actually ordered it for my wife for Christmas one year. I completely spaced on the name of what it is, but yeah, there was a price I couldn't beat and figured my wife could also use a clean shave.
One of the advantages of having an actual bike rider join us is that we can talk about things like tech or listen to Ian talking about tech. And Ian, you were saying, I mean, time trials are always good for a bit of tech spotting. And in fact, Daniel had a few tech questions or observations after the time trial in Palermo. But you were saying when we were chatting just now, that there were a couple of things you spotted in the time trial today.
Yeah, well, I've been impressed, or I've kind of been blown away by how far time trial tech has come in the last few years. You know, it used to be a relatively, well, I don't want to say it was ever a level playing field, but, you know, the tech and equipment involved in time trialing has advanced so much. I mean, you see today with Dennis and Ghana up front, and one thing that I really picked up on both those riders is the 3D printed handlebars, and Ghana's, you know, whether you call them the skis or the extensions, it's incredible. I mean, it's crazy how, you know, far it is from the base bar of his time trial bar up to where his hands are resting. And I know that there's a lot of rules in place from the UCI as far as regulations, as angle of angles, you know, the tip of the bars to the saddle. And there's all sorts of, you know, rules that you have to, your bike has to fit within the jig at the start line. But it's crazy to see with 3D printing just how far they can push those limits. And there's a rule that your elbow pads have to be, I believe it's 10 centimeters. There can't be a 10 centimeter gap between your elbow pads and the end of the extension. And I've noticed today on Ghana's bike that they, you know, his elbows aren't even resting in the pad. It's actually more of his forearm, just so he's within that regulation, but still allows him to get that position. And there's all sorts of kind of little tricks that people play to meet that standard. And I was teammates with Harry Tanfield, and he had said that his TT position wasn't legal. His elbow pads were too low. So he put in some carpeting foam and added about 7 inches of, or 7 centimeters of foam that, you know, met the jig. But then when he compressed it, putting his weight on it, you know, he was able to attain the position that he wanted to. So it's fascinating to see how far technology has come, and to see a rider like Ghana in such an incredible position for such a big guy. You know, it looks like he could probably ride a bigger frame size, but with the ability to have a 3D printed bar, he's really able to get to maximize his aero position.
Well, when you see him, it looks like the perfect marriage between the perfect position and the perfect athlete. You know, I mean, it looks like, you know, the kind of, no doubt we'll look back on it in 10 years and think, you know, it wasn't, or they're, you know, it'll look dated then. But right at this moment, and I kind of, this is maybe what Cancellara was talking about, you know, it looks like the end of evolution in a way of that position and everything. I mean, I remember seeing him on the track, you know, riding a pursuit and being really struck by what a specimen he is and what position he had then as well. And when he is in full flight in a time trial, and there was a, you know, tough climb in today's time trial, but the steadiness of his position on the bike and the power that you can see him putting out is really, really impressive.
A big day for Pinarello, really, because this more or less home turf. Obviously, Ghana and Dennis both riding on Pinarello bikes, and Pinarello are just down the road, founded in Treviso, owned by an American private equity company now, I think, or the parent company is anyway. So yeah, it was the Pinarello stage, it was the Prosecco stage, and the Tiramisu stage.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. Don't need to ask you, Ian. We know that you know it. That's great. SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com.
And if you want 35% off, listen to Ian's podcast, Breakfast with Boz.
good shout there, Lionel. Oh, dear.
I did actually mean to... I meant to mention your podcast at some point, Ian, because... I really enjoyed your recent one with Pete Kenyuk and Marcel Kittel on retirement, on the subject of retirement. It's a great listen if anybody wants to hear. You know, it's clear that Kenyuk's not always the easiest guy for us to interview, but you clearly know him very well and have a great rapport with him. And he really opened up to you, and I thought you got the best out of him. And it's a great listen. A lot of your podcasts have been great, but that's enough of that. Let's move on. Breakfast with Boz, you'll find it on all your podcast apps. Yes, so listen, we're going to hear in this part from one of our audio diarists, Joe Dombrowski, writing for UAE Team Emirates, and a good friend of yours, Ian.
He is, yeah. I joined Team Sky in 2013 with Joe, and we've spent many a years racing together, both on Action and then at Team Sky. And when we both changed teams, he still lives in Nice, and I live just down the road. So we've spent countless days and hours riding our bikes together.
I mean, I guess, well, you were contemporaries, weren't you? There he is at the Giro. We're going to hear from him soon. And he talked, you know, we know that he's been unwell. He's had a couple of really ropey days, where he struggled to finish. But you know, having been through so much with him, knowing him so well, and been, you know, tracking each other for so many years, is it strange for you to think of him off there riding the Giro while you're at home there in Vermont?
No, I mean, I guess I've kind of come to terms that a lot of my friends are still off racing. And I, you know, for some reason, early on in Joe's career, he really fell in love with Italy. I think it probably started when he won the Baby Giro in 2012. He beat Fabio Aru. And I was actually there helping him at that race. And I actually caught a stomach bug and had to drop out on, I think it was the Tornale climb, stage that he won. But I caught a stomach bug, was out of the race, and thankfully Joe is still in Italy racing. But it just dawned on me hearing him send in his audio file that, you know, riders have so few chances at Grand Tours, and Joe's coming off 2019, he had a phenomenal Giro. I think he was 10th or maybe 11th or 12th. And, you know, he really was expecting this year to, you know, kind of climb the ladder and have another big opportunity at the Giro. Obviously things were changed due to COVID, but, you know, he did start the Giro and had high aspirations. And it's just crazy to realize that it's something as small as a stomach bug. You know, that's one year and one Grand Tour that, you know, the Joe's not going to have an opportunity to go for GC. And that, you know, you look at any cyclist career, and I know this probably better than most at this point, is, you know, it can end at any point. And the fact that, you know, that's one race that Joe's not going to be able to go for GC, you know, could ultimately be one lost year. So hopefully he can recover and come back in the third week and maybe go for a stage win or help McNulty.
Something else that struck me today watching the coverage, Rob Hatch talked a little bit about that team's, that's UAE Team Emirates, kind of history and riders that have been through that system. And he mentioned a few times that it's the old Lamprey team. And when you look at them now and what they've become, it's almost impossible to marry that with the old Lamprey team, who were always kind of serial underperformers, or, you know, very, very Italian team, who didn't really punch much of a hole laterally. As UAE Team Emirates now, and we're seeing that particularly this year, they're a real powerhouse. You know, they've won stages here. They've got lots of talented young riders, Brandon McNulty among them. And that sort of disconnect between the old Lamprey team and the modern UAE Team Emirates kind of struck me today. But let's hear from Joe. Here's Joe Dombrowski.
Good morning from the morning of the second time trial here at the Giro. We're at stage 14. Great stage win again. Second for us from Diego yesterday. Reduced bunch sprint. You know, actually, Bora was controlling in the race, and I think they thought they had a good chance. But I also think that the climbs were probably a little bit harder than maybe what everyone expected. And in the end, it was a pretty small group of really more, I would say, GC-type guys that were in front. And, you know, someone like Diego that can make it over is for sure one of the fastest out of a group like that. And McNulty gave him, I think, a good lead out in the last kilometer, and yeah, he was able to win the stage. So it's good for us. Today we've got the time trial. You know, a TT in the middle of the race like this for a lot of guys is a bit more of an easy day. You know, if you can win the TT or do a great ride, then it's something different. Or if you're riding for GC, then of course it's, you know, 100% effort. But also a lot of guys look to this day as kind of a day to take it a bit easier. Me personally, for me, it'll be, you know, a chance to recover a bit. I think I said in my last update I picked up some kind of stomach bug after the first rest day, and this week's been quite a struggle for me. I was talking with the team doctor before the Cesenatico stage yesterday, and we weren't sure if I was going to start or not, because it was really, and to be honest, the fact that I finished the stage was already a surprise. It was looking doubtful, but I'm hoping that, you know, yesterday I was able to take it a bit easier, and then also today in the TT, the plan is to just kind of take it a bit easier, and I'm hoping that I'm able to kind of bounce back from that and have a good final week. It's just been, you know, anytime you get a sort of stomach virus that can really be pretty draining. So yeah, looking forward. And then tomorrow is the last day before the rest day. There's been, you know, speculation about whether the fact that weather and or COVID could have an impact on the final week. You know, if the final week is raced at all, or if potentially some of the climbs before summit finishes are removed, and whether that would impact the tactics of the teams. I think, you know, we're at quite a, to be now we're at stage 14 and the GC is actually very tight in terms of time. I mean, I can't remember a Grand Tour where it's been so tight this late in the race. And I think some of that is owed to the fact that, you know, we did Etna and that was really the only summit finish of the race. We also finished at Rocca Rosso, but it's not such a hard finish. I mean, I think in front in the GC group, there was probably 25 of us going into the last kilometer. So it's not particularly selective. And other than that, it's been just a TT. So there's not been a lot to break up the race, and it's kind of awaiting this final week. Tomorrow, stage to Piancavallo, there's some climbs before. I don't see any teams that are really showing that they're stronger than the rest in this Giro. I don't know if people are thinking about it tactically in terms of do they need to be more aggressive now to take advantage if the race were to end early, or if we don't, you know, have some of the harder mountain stages as planned. If that's the case, I could imagine that, you know, someone like Nibali would benefit from a harder race on maybe the climbs before Piancavallo tomorrow. But again, we'll just have to see. I mean, he hasn't shown that, he hasn't shown maybe his best form yet, but it, like I said, it hasn't been the most selective Giro. And also, you know, how strong is his team? Like I said, there's a lot of teams that I don't think anyone seems particularly dominant and who can really open up the race. So for today, for me, it's kind of an easy day, hoping to recover and get over this bug and hopefully have a good last week. We've got Mikael Bjerg, who can do a good result in the TT, and McNulty is, he's ridden really well in this Giro, and he's kind of quietly sitting, I think, still just outside the top 10, but like I said, the time gaps are so tight. And, you know, again, quietly in the first TT, he was one of the best guys in the first TT that's still up there on GC. And I think he could surprise today, and I wouldn't put it past him to really certainly move into the top 10, and I think it's even possible top 5, because he's a strong time trial rider, and the gaps are still small, and I think it's going to be a good day for him. Let's hope so, and then looking forward to Piancavallo, and then the rest day in a couple days.
Well, Joe Dombrowski there, battling through with his stomach problem, illness. Hopefully gets better in the third week. But looking ahead to Sunday's stage, and it's a big stage, and it's a tough stage, I guess, after a time trial, because, you know, for the main GC riders, they'll have emptied themselves in the time trial. It's a huge effort. So it'll be a test of how riders have recovered from that. And their teams, you know, that was an interesting aspect today. I was quite surprised to see the Koenig Quickstep guys, James Knox and Fausto Masnada, both rode pretty hard, it looked like, or they're just in fantastic form, but they certainly didn't take it easy. And that's, I guess it's a bit of a hedging of the bets, because, you know, Almeida's not yet a proven kind of GC leader. It's still risky to throw all their weight behind him, even though he's in the pink jersey. So I was quite surprised to see just how hard, how fast they went today. And it'll be a big day for them tomorrow as well. But is that something that you experienced, Ian, or observed in others, that the day after time trial can be particularly tough?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time kind of doing what Dombrowski said, taking it easy in time trials, almost trying to treat it like a rest day. But the truth is, you know, you really, there is a time cut, and you know, you really are, you're still probably riding that, you know, 85% or 90% of what the guys at the front are doing. And there's something to be said about, you know, maybe keeping on the pedals and keep pushing to actually keep your body ready for the next day. I mean, today's time trial was, you know, 42 minutes, so it's not a short effort, but there is something to be said. If you have that form, you might as well, you know, ride it. And you know, what's the difference really between, you know, someone like, look at someone like Knox or Masnada, you know, are they really gonna, you know, damage themselves that much between riding at 90% and 100%? And yeah, they're keeping their options open going forward. And you look at a stage like tomorrow, and who knows, maybe one of them could, if things really go crazy on some of the climbs early on, if they can make a split and go up the road, then they potentially have a reason to not be putting other riders on the front.
That's a really good point, actually. I mean, because that's another kind of option for them, isn't it? Where they can put other teams and riders under pressure and take the pressure off Almeida at the same time. We've got the Tour of Flanders tomorrow as well. One thing we should mention from the Giro, which I meant to mention earlier, is Giulio Ciccone is out, isn't he? Because he has been unwell. He had COVID, actually, and the team doctor seemed to sort of link his illness, although it's not COVID, you know, his recovery from COVID has taken a bit of time, and he's out of the race. That was an important helper for Vincenzo Nibali. But yeah, the Tour of Flanders is tomorrow, chaps. Who's going to win the Tour of Flanders? Go on, Lionel.
Well, I don't really do speculation, do I? I mean, it's a very strong field for the Tour of Flanders, isn't it? I mean, Alaphilippe, Van der Poel, Van Aert, Oliver Naassen. I mean, that's Mads Pedersen. I mean, that's a strong front group, isn't it? Kwiatkowski, I expect, will be in the mix. Tish Benoot, Alexander Kristoff. I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens. It's a little bit shorter, of course, isn't it? So 20-ish kilometres have been trimmed off the route. So it's 243, I think, instead of, well, you'd normally expect it to be 260-ish. Whether that has too much of a bearing, I don't know. I mean, obviously, these races are decided in the final hour and a half, aren't they? So if the final hour and a half comes that little bit earlier, it might mean it's a more open race. But it's going to be a day for double screening, isn't it? The Giro on one side and the Tour of Flanders on the other.
Interested to note as well that the women's Tour of Flanders is starting quite late tomorrow and finishing about an hour after the men's race, which that hasn't happened before. I don't think, I'm pretty sure it hasn't happened before. Anna van der Breggen, I guess, will be the favourite for that one. But who are your favourites, Ian, tomorrow?
Oh, the classics are always a hard one to pick, and especially not kind of having the traditional run-up. I know there's a bit of a spat between Van Aert and Van der Poel, but yeah, I mean, just the way that Van Aert has been riding all year, I'm gonna put my money on him, and yeah, that's my pick. I haven't been following the classics as closely as I've been following the Giro, and I will not be joining you tomorrow. I'm gonna be off doing my own bike ride race up here in Vermont, so I'll be bundled up, but I'll catch up with you guys later next week.
I do think that if a rivalry with a little bit of needle to it could emerge between Van Aert and Van der Poel, you know, that could really ignite and see us through the next sort of 4 or 5 years of cobbled classics. I mean, I was actually, Orla Chenoui posted something on Instagram asking her followers, you know, what it is they like about cycling, but also what could, you know, generate more coverage for the sport. And I was pondering this afternoon, thinking that there hasn't really been much in the way of a real kind of needle rivalry between riders, and often it gets kind of dampened down now, doesn't it? Social media, I think, has a because things flare up and threaten to kind of get out of control and grow legs of their own. If there is any kind of dispute, there's often a rush to kind of, you know, throw a wet blanket over any genuine beef between either riders or teams. And I think we need a bit of friendly needle. I'm not necessarily saying animosity, but if we could see the emergence of a real kind of, you know, cat and dog rivalry between Van Aert and Van der Poel. That would be something to look forward to, I think.
We had a carpaccio beef at the Giro between Fuglsang and Nibali. Don't forget.
True, but I mean that's like a couple of guys in the retirement home hitting each other with their Zimmer frames, isn't it? I mean that's not got legs, has it? These guys are 10 years younger.
Maybe the maybe the spat between Van Aert and Van der Poel can be the spat of the American beef. If you've ever been to Belgium, they have that it's like raw beef. It's like a beef tartare that they spread on sandwiches. I lived in Belgium for a while, and yeah, it's kind of a nasty thing they put on sandwiches, but it comes from the region of these two.
It sounds raw beef paste.
It sounds right up Lionel Street, to be honest.
Yeah, I've had the kind of the strange dried chewing beef they have there, you know, that you can basically never ever digest, I don't think. But I've not come across the raw beef paste. I mean, even I might think twice about that.
Well, listen, fellas, Ian, good luck with your ride race tomorrow on gravel, isn't it? Bit of gravel.
It is, yeah. We actually woke up to a little bit of snow this morning, so it's gonna be a cold one. But yeah, gravel, a little bit of single track mountain bike trail, and I'll do my best to stay safe and stay warm enough to make it home to the fire.
And you're joining us again on Tuesday evening, I believe.
That's correct.
That will be where we'll ask you whether you prefer the Giro or the Vuelta, because the Vuelta will be underway and we'll be, how are we going to tackle this, Rich? We're going to have to kind of keep a real close look on the Giro because it's coming to the end. But if anything, interesting happens at the Vuelta, we'll cover that as well, won't we?
Well, we'll have our man there, Daniel. We hope to check in with Daniel while he's there. And we'll do our best. This is the grandest tour after all. A huge undertaking for everybody, not least our listeners.
We'll do an hour special on Depana next week as well, I expect.
We'll see about Depana, shall we? Anyway, let's leave it there for now. We usually do thanks to friends of the podcast at this point, but I'm afraid I haven't dug out the names. I could just do that now if you want. Shall I?
My phone's about to die any minute.
Sorry, let's just leave it. We'll do that next time. Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, guys.